Gotta gather my tools of the trade here. I've got a little timer because I can run on and lose track of it, and a lot of ground I hope to cover. Got my big book. This is a little bitty big book. Doesn't have the stories, but I love what it says inside the cover. This was put together by something called the Anonymous Press, and it says a bunch of folks trying to carry the AA message and staying sober by carrying the AA, and they're from Mallow, Washington. So I looked it up on the map. There are 50 people in Mallow, Washington. And I thought, that is really cool, a bunch of folks out of 50 people. I'm real excited and a little bit terrified to be here. I've spoken at conferences like this before, but never this big. I've been on committees for these conferences, I forgot to mention, I'm a weeper. I can, you know, just at the drop of a hat. So I was just entering one of those moments, and you've told me that if I drink, I can't cry and drink water at the same time. So if you see this and you see this, something's going on, and I'll be right back. So my wife and I live in Camden, Maine, and that is 3,350 miles away from here. And so I'm going to try to do a number of things here in this time coming up. I'm going to try to tell you how I got here from there. I want to try to tell you what I think my job is here speaking to you. And then I'll go into the usual, not the usual, but what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that means I got to talk about the steps, because that's what happened. And that means I'll be ending with 10, 11, and 12. That means I'll be talking about what it means to have a spiritual awakening, and what it means to carry a message, and what it means to, what principles these are that we're trying to practice. That means I'll be talking about the traditions, which for me, I think that's Bill Wilson's real genius. I've heard you say how the Oxford groups developed the steps before he got to them, that the steps are to help me live with me, which is true for me. The traditions are to help me live with you. And then when you get to the message, that means I'll be on page 164, because the message for me, the message for me is, if I will see to it that that my relationship with the creative power that got me here, if that relationship is right, whatever right means to me, and I get my own conception about what it means to me, but if that relationship is right, if it's working, I'm going to have a great life. And right after that, it says, this is the great fact for us. So I hope if I don't get across anything else, I want to say at the heart and soul of this whole deal for me is developing a relationship with higher power. Okay, some lighter stuff. So Oregon and Maine are a lot alike. Your Washington is our Massachusetts. You may not get that right away, but your California is our New York, and around Maine you see lots of flannel shirts, and you see a lot of them around Oregon. We wear fluffy vests too, but ours say L.L. Bean, yours say Columbia. And I've seen more suspenders around here. We seem to have fewer of those in Maine, but farming, fishing, forestry, they're all big deals in the state of Maine. And Seaside and Camden are a whole lot alike. They're both 5,000 souls, and they both grow during the summer. We're a summer community as well. And believe it or not, we are both 85, 90 miles away from a Portland airport. And we're both right on the water. We're on the Atlantic, you're on the Pacific. So how did I get here to Seaside from Camden? Well, my son moved here from from Southern California in 2013. So in July, I better start this thing. I didn't even start this thing. And if you hear dee, 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 that means I gotta wrap it up. He moved here he and his wife moved here in July of 2013, and I came out for like a 48-hour trip, and I'm looking for an AA meeting, and so I go online and find out there's an AA meeting on 3rd Avenue. There's a little number there, and so I say to my son, where's 3rd Avenue? And sometimes he's a man of few words, and he points out the window, and he says, that's 3rd Avenue. And so I got to walk to the little yellow house for my first 7 a.m. meeting, and every time I'm, thank you. Oh, you know, I forgot, thank you for saying that. I forgot to mention that what Camden, Maine, what we don't have a little yellow house, and we don't have a convention center, and we don't have 36th North Coast Roundup, and you know what else we don't have, Harlan? I didn't know, I barely know him, but that's something you all have, and I can see his presence everywhere here, I haven't practiced this, but I've run it through my mind so much I'm screwing it all up. What I wanted to say was how much I love Alcoholics Anonymous and how annoyed I can get with alcoholics sometimes, and because I find that many of us are self-centered takers, and one of the things that we can take is we can take stuff for granted, and one of the things we can take for granted is somebody like Harlan or anybody in our lives that means something to us, and then when they disappear, it's like, wow, I didn't get my chance to say, I'm glad I knew you, I'm glad you're in my life, So I just want to say that because he has a lot to do with this thing, and you can see him everywhere. And I want to go on from that to I loved the way Sonia talked about her relationship with Julie, and my wife's sitting right here. I do not think relationships can last a long time if we don't let our partners know that we are grateful for their presence in our lives. So I just wanted to say that. Now I got to remember where I was, and I'm trying not to look down at all these notes that I've made up about it. So at any rate, I'm going to the little yellow house, and one of the first people that I meet is Mike B. And it turns out that Mike B. has been to every one of these 36 roundups, and I think that's pretty amazing. And a guy sitting back there, Terry, he's been to all 36 of these roundups. And then I met a guy named Louie up in Astoria. He'd been to 35 of them, and Steve somewhere, he's been to 34 of them. That blows my mind, as you say. Okay, now, I knew this was going to happen. I'm old, and you'll be running along pretty good, and then psh, all of a sudden, it just, blankness. So I'm glad I got these notes. Oh yeah, Mike B. So I'm getting to know Mike B. And you know, it's typical that as you're getting to know somebody, and I don't know. So at one point, I ask him, "You lived here all your life?" And he starts describing to me how he had been born up in the Portland area and had been important when he came to Seaside and all of that. And I said, you know, in Maine, that's kind of a trick question, because when you ask a state of Mainer, you lived here all your life, he'll look at you and he'll wink and he'll go, not yet. this next piece comes from a story that was told, gosh, it's got to be 70 years ago now. This is a car story, sort of. Do you have dooryards out here? Anybody know what a dooryard is? Well, we have dooryards, and it means the yard that's in front of your door, because you have a number of yards. And so this main guy is out in his dooryard doing something, And he hears this car come zooming down the road and goes by, and it screeches down at this end, and then it turns around and comes roaring back the other way and screeches down at this end, and then comes back and stops right in front of him. No pleasantries, no nothing. They're probably from Massachusetts, I don't know, but but they say, "Which way to East Vassalboro?" And he looks at him for a while, and I forgot to mention that we not only have a Portland, Maine, we have a new Portland, Maine, and then we have a new North New Portland, Maine. So East Vassalboro, obviously there's a, and these are towns of, I don't know, 20 to 50, maybe 100 people sometimes. So the farmer, he's got this question of which way to East Vassalboro, and he starts going, "Well, you couldn't keep going the way you came here. And then when you get to the T-stop, you take a left, you go down a little ways and take a right, and then you're going to come to, oh, no, no, no," he thinks, that bridge is out. You can't go that way. And then he said, "Well, go back, turn around and go back this way, and when you get to that T-stop, take a right, go down there a ways. When you see the big tree on the left, you take a right there, and then you're going to come to, oh, no, you can't do that either. Those railroad tracks, they're doing something on them." He goes, "Come to think of it, you can't get there from here." And I guess I could say, if you saw me 9 years ago, you would say, "You're never going to get there from here." And that's true. And it reminds me of, there's a moment in the book, at the end of More About Alcoholism, when the psychiatrist is talking, and he's saying, "There is no doubt in my mind that two of you," and he's referring to Bill and I think Hank Parkhurst, "were 100% hopeless without divine help. And if you had presented yourselves for help at my hospital, I would have turned you down if I could. People like you are too heartbreaking." Ooh, ouch. And I know that's where I was, and I know in acknowledging my wife that I wouldn't be here were it not for her. I was breaking her heart. And it's a hard thing to think about your bottom, but I swear, I have done your steps, and I didn't do them because I was seeking a relationship with God. I was doing them because I didn't want to drink again. And I kept hearing you say, "If you don't do these steps, you will drink again." And but at the time, it was not. So it's like the God thing is an added bonus for just getting back to somewhat normal. Okay, I'm going to turn the page here. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention. So I also got to know Elaine. Elaine, I think, is here. And it was a result of Elaine that I wound up doing this workshop that Marshall referred to. And during that workshop, I mentioned a person's name that I may mention again today that has had a lot of influence on our fellowship. And I think that's what actually got me to this invitation. But I got this invitation a long time ago, and I've been thinking about it and thinking about it for, it's like a year now. So I hope you'll bear with me. Okay. What's my job? Couple of quotes in the book. I'm a technical kind of guy. I get into the minutiae of information sometimes, and so in the early going for me to when we'd be at a literature-based meeting and we're reading a story, I'd get kind of antsy, and what's the point of these stories? You know, I wanted tips. I wanted technical tips on how to do this thing, I didn't feel like I was getting them out of the story. So my sponsor pointed out, it says this on page 29, if you want to know. "Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed, they flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. You bet. If what we have learned and seen and felt means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living and loving Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest and open enough to try. So I think that's what my job is, talking about how that happened for me. So now I'm going to move on into what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But before I get rolling, I just want to say, I'm saying this because I can get confused and whatever. I hope that I make clear three big points for me. I remember my sponsor saying early in our going that our first waypoint was the ABCs, and I really appreciated that because he was saying, you know, our first job is getting you convinced that you are an alcoholic and cannot manage your own life, what that means to say that, that no human power is going to solve your problem, but that spiritual power can and will if you will seek it. So I like threes, things in threes. So these are three things that I'm hoping I can convey appropriately to you. First is that if you are a real alcoholic, and I will take some time to say what that means to me, if you are a real alcoholic, you only have two options. And it says it on, I can't remember which page, but it says one option is to blot out of my mind as best I can how miserable I feel, to the bitter end, I think it even says, and the other is to accept spiritual help. And I say that because I feel like our biggest risks are complacency and contempt prior to investigation. And I think that's the purgatory in between these two options, that we can get to a place either inside AA or whatever it is where we're comfortable, and we're not comfortable enough to keep on pushing in whatever way we're guided and directed to push. So that's the first point. If you're a real alcoholic, you got only two choices, accepting spiritual help, or trying to blot out of your mind, trying to find comfort in some other kind of way. And the second point I want to make is that the heart of this whole thing for me has been prayer. And I came in here not practicing prayer, not being a believer in prayer. Just as the book says, I thought that was for weak people. And it's becoming, prayer is the whole thing for me. So I will be emphasizing that as we run through this thing. And then the third point I'd like to make is my sponsor said to me, he said, if I do my job, you are going to be I was loved hearing what Sonia said about sponsoring and sponsoring as early as the opportunity shows up. He said, you will hear sometimes you got to give it away to keep it. And he said, in his experience, that's a little bit of a misstatement. He said, you got to give it away to really get it. That it's by trying to help another form this working relationship with the creative power underlying the whole deal. That's how I grow. And so I hope to emphasize those three points. Okay, I'm looking at the timer. Jeez, just it goes so fast. Okay, so I was born a long, long time ago. I was born 9 months after my father got home from World War II. And I had an older sister who wanted to be an only child. And I have a younger sister and two younger brothers, and they may show up in this talk as we go along. And I don't remember a whole lot before 8, 9, 10 years old. I mean, I remember a lot more 8, 9, 10 years old. And I remember I've both listened to the tapes of Chuck C. delivering that talk, A New Pair of Glasses, and that was turned into the book, A New Pair of Glasses, and he said something that really caught my attention. He said, in his opinion, after his time in AA, he felt that many of us have three really common characteristics, and the first of those was that we are emotionally more sensitive than the average human being, that we just plain feel things more deeply than average human beings do. He says, don't confuse this with emotional immaturity. We are emotionally immature, but we just plain feel things deeper. And then he said this second thing. He said that we have a deep interior awareness that life is supposed to be a big and a good and a beautiful loving thing. That we know somewhere down deep. He says he felt it at 7, 8, 9 years old. He knew it wasn't supposed to be this way. And that's what I was starting to say, that I knew at 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, our family dinners would start off. Both my parents are alcoholics, and my father's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we're sitting around the table, and things go along okay. So talking about, you know, I thought my family was functional. I thought this is just the way it is. But, you know, and then something would happen, and the whole thing would just go to, I won't say the words, but it would get rather difficult. And somewhere in my little mind, I knew this was not the way it was supposed to be. And then the third thing he said is, we are relentless perfectionists. We want things better, and we're real good at seeing things that ain't right, ain't quite right. And that was my experience. I suffer from perfectionism for sure, and it's why I've had so much trouble getting ready for this talk, because I'm not afraid of you, actually, and coming this morning and just being here with you all, you know, I'm not afraid of you. I'm afraid of me. I'm afraid when I get done, you know, and somebody says something nice, and my mind's gonna say, yeah, but you didn't say this, and you spent too much time on that, and but what about that, and you know. But it is what it is. Any rate, so my experience is I could not live in that tension. I could not live in the tension of feeling this stuff so intensely, and it really accelerated when I got to the teenage years. And sometimes in my little mind, I mean, the book says deep down in every one of us is the fundamental idea of God. It may be covered by pomp, by calamity, by worship of other things, but it is there. And I feel like that's what he's talking about. The deep down in me, I know this is a miracle. This is a life, human life is a flat out miracle. That's not what I'm seeing. That's not what I'm experiencing. What I'm experiencing is inner anguish, and in my case, tons of fear. Just tons of fear about everything. Well, you can't live in that tension. You know, I am extremely grateful for alcohol. I'm extremely grateful for alcohol itself, because I don't think I would have made it to age 30 without alcohol. I really don't. I couldn't handle the tension that was going on for me. And I'm really grateful that I've got an allergy to alcohol, which means I'm not a normal drinker. I can't drink one or two or three, whatever. Because I'm convinced personally, I was 63 years old when I came in here. My sobriety date is New Year's Day. I just remembered. I was going to make you work this out mathematically, but so live the dream. I just want to tell you about my dream. If my dream comes true, New Year's Day, 2040. I'll get wheeled up to the front of the room in some dingy church basement somewhere, and I'll have an oxygen bottle and Jan Ramon. I'll be wearing diapers, and one of you will hand me a 30-year medallion. That's my hope, and. And then I can die a happy man. Okay, so let's see. I'm already behind schedule. The book. I just love our book. I love our book, and I love the way I've been reading it a while now, and I keep reading it, and I keep finding new stuff, and I love things like the alcoholic is usually an extreme example of self will run riot, and he doesn't think so, you know, and that's true for me. I thought I knew what I was doing. If you questioned my use of alcohol, I wouldn't have been very polite, but I honestly thought I knew what I was doing. And so I'm grateful that I have this allergy, because if my life hadn't broken down and my wife and my brother hadn't intervened in my life, I know I wouldn't be here. I know I wouldn't be here. So it makes me grateful for that. Okay. I'm gonna move on. So what was it like? We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living that was satisfying, blah, 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 blah. Suffering from the bedevilments with no idea what was wrong, and I was a seeker. I mean, I've done a lot of different things, seeking spiritual, whatever you call it, truth or help or whatever it is. But I was suffering from these bedevilments, and the hallmark of it at the end for me was a deep, deep depression. And I was drinking 24/7, and I remember going to the doctor, because I know something's wrong, and I'm asking about aunt abuse. And so I say, well, doc, if I want to drink, how long do I have to stop the aunt abuse before I can drink? And he says, well, it takes about 2 weeks to take effect, so I'd guess 2 weeks to, whoop, nope. That's not possible. I knew I couldn't do that. But let's see, I just whoop, took off on me. So I'm going to look down at my notes and see where I was. Oh, yeah. So the steps mean everything to me, but I ran through them in the beginning, and ran through them because I didn't want to drink again. The second part of step one about this unmanageability stuff, I just did not get that at all. In fact, if anything, I thought I was learning how to manage my alcoholism is what I really thought I was doing, and so I love it when. When right in the first part, the doctor's opinion, right at the end of the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth says, I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though you came to scoff, you will remain to pray. And I really love it. Coming from a medical man, he's not a clergyman, and he's saying indirectly, they don't say it till the spiritual appendix, the only thing that will completely prohibit you from growing spiritually is contempt prior to investigation. My judgment of anything prior to investigating whether or not it's true, and particularly prayer. So I had no relationship with prayer in the beginning. I'm doing this more than I thought. I thought I could just roll through this. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the hard drinker and the real alcoholic. It describes it early in the book, and it makes an important point, I think, for me. I come down the stairs in our home in Camden at 7 o'clock in the morning, and my brother is standing there, and I know the jig is up, so I start immediately going, how am I going to get out of this one? My wife had called him to come up and she would need to do something because this depression was just killing me and breaking her heart. So he had no idea I had a problem with alcohol, and he puts his arm around me, and I'm just weeping. Puts his arm around me, and he says, it's really simple. Just don't drink. And you know what my mind says? You don't understand. You don't understand. You don't understand. And it turns out, and later on, I've had a conversation with him, and I said, you're a hard drinker. You're not a real alcoholic. I can't just not. You know when people say, just don't drink no matter what? Well, what it says in the book is, The real alcoholic can't just no drink, just not drink no matter what. We can't without lack of power is our dilemma. We can't pull that off. If I could pull that off, just not drink no matter what do I need to do all this stuff for? And particularly, what do I need to invite spiritual power into my life? And so, anyway, I wanted to make that point. But what's it mean to say I'm a real alcoholic? To me, it goes back to that triangle that we talk about so often: unity, recovery, service, and the interpretation of that. And this comes from this guy, this guy named Don Pritz. It didn't come from him. He was taught it by somebody else, but he was from the Denver, Colorado area, and he started Fellowships of the Spirit, and it's a lot of people that he's sponsored mean a whole lot to me. But they talk about, they used to be, we had this circle and triangle in our book on the very first page, and a sponsor would take you there and go, this is what this means, and this is what this is about. And I say again, if we get our own conception about the most important part of this deal, which is higher power, we get our own, you can have your own conception of what this triangle means. I'm giving you mine, and that is that the unity side represents the fellowship, represents the physical body of our fellowship, and our purpose of our meetings is to stay sober and help another alcoholic achieve sobriety, but the purpose of our steps is to come to a spiritual awakening, and that's represented by that recovery line, and that's done one to another over the kitchen table or sitting in a car outside a meeting or wherever it is that it takes place. But that's a one-on-one thing. And then we get to the service side, which is my relationship with my Creator and how I improve upon that relationship. So to me, it means I've got to acknowledge that I have an allergy to alcohol, that I'm an abnormal drinker. When I drink one, I experience the phenomenon of craving. I have to go on and drink another. But then I've got this mental aspect. The book is very clear. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, not in his body. Sonia said it earlier. So we all get our own names for that, and my favorite name is the strange mental blank spot. It comes out of the story about Fred, who's in more about alcoholism, and the strange mental blank spot, what he says and what I can say, my life looked good. I have a beautiful wife. I have two children. She has two children. You know, we live in a beautiful little town. I'm not in legal trouble. I'm not in financial trouble. I'm not in relationship trouble. But I've got this strange mental blank spot about my relationship with alcohol. And I loved how Sonia talked about it as it was my solution. It was not my problem. It was my solution. But then I got this third thing. The third thing we talk about, the spiritual malady. And that means I don't have any relationship with my higher power. I'm going to jump ahead here, but we get a chance, if we go into step four, we get a chance to do this inventory of how we're doing internally with our resentment and our fear and our sense of guilt and shame. I'm trying to say too much now, but when you hit the fear part, the fear part talks about we put our fears down on paper, we ask ourselves why we have these fears, and then it says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And to go back to my depression, I think the reason I was depressed is I was starting to realize on some level I had done everything my mind had told me to do to have a good life, to have a good and decent life, and to be a decent citizen of the communities that I was in. And I wanted to die. I felt like those hideous four horsemen in the beginning of A Vision to You: terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. You know, they were circled around, and I had no idea what to do, and no idea that this was the failure of my self-reliance is what got me into that situation. And I'm still working on that. My sponsors taught me all the good you can accomplish in word substitution. And he says, you know, when the book talks about our drinking, you can substitute our thinking, and the sentence will make sense for you. And then when it talks about alcoholism or the alcoholic, you can substitute agnosticism or the agnostic, and the sentence will make sense to you. Isn't that interesting? So my spiritual malady, I feel, is that I don't have any relationship with higher power. So the only thing I've got is this. And if this thing keeps telling me, I know it didn't work, I know it didn't work, but it's going to work this time. You know, talk about resentment. I had an honest profession. I consider myself an honest person. And my sponsor says, well, you know, the big primary colors of character defects are selfishness, dishonesty, and fear. And so what we do when we get to the sex conduct, we're looking at selfishness. That's the key topic. When we're in the fear inventory, we're looking at fear. When we're in the resentment inventory, we're looking at dishonesty. And I'm going, what do you mean dishonest? I don't see the dishonesty in resentment. I resent you because you're a jerk and it's really making me feel bad. That's, you know, that's pretty clear and obvious. But then you wind up in the fourth column looking at where am I, selfish, dishonest, or frightened. And my mind is taking off at me again, but the dishonesty happens in those first three columns. I think you're my problem. I think I feel bad because of your behavior. And I believe it. I believe my own thinking. And then the second level of dishonesty for me is, I think resenting you is going to make the world a better place. Because when you start to feel my resentment, you're going to, why is Jack treating me that? You know, you're going to examine your behavior. You will see the error of your ways, and you will act better, more appropriately, as I think, and voila, I'll be happy, you'll be happy, and the world will be a better place. That's what, and I, part of my self-concept is I need to think I'm pretty smart. So when my sponsor starts to point this stuff out, he always had these two really annoying questions. You know, I'd whine and complain about whatever, and the first one was, not too bad, how's that working for you? You know? And then, but the second one was, what are you going to do about it? You know, that was, oh. Okay, let's see. Now I don't know where I'm at. I know I'm in the steps, and I know I'm on four. Oh, but I skipped something on, well, I'll come back to that. I'll leave that. I'll come back to that, too. Well, no, maybe I'll go back there just so I can say somewhat in order. Okay, so we all know a lot about, I'm a devoted student of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a devoted student of our history, and I love working around the edges. And I've read about our co-founders, and then one of you pointed out to me, you know, we have several pre-founders. There are six people. And if these six people didn't do a particular thing at a particular time, we're not even here having this conversation. You know, the book never gets written, let alone a meeting in my hometown. And he started talking about two doctors, two clergymen, and two alcoholics. And the first doctor is Silkworth. You know, the first doctor is the guy that says, there's something about you people. Alcoholism's been around a long, long time. And he says, you people are different. Physiologically, you people are different. You're not normal drinkers. Something happens to you when you drink that doesn't happen to other people. And the second doctor is this guy, Carl Jung. And he shows up early in the program, and he's talking to Roland Hazard. And I don't know how much you know. Roland Hazard's a wealthy guy. Goes over. It's like going to the finest rehab in the world. For a year, he spends a year with Carl Jung, who's considered the finest psychiatrist on the planet at the time, and Jung leaves there. I mean, Hazard leaves there and gets drunk again right away. Goes back to Carl Jung, and I hope you'll pardon the pun. Says, "What's up, Doc?" Because it's like I've just spent all this money and all this time, and it hasn't worked. And Jung says these terrifying words. He says, I have never seen an alcoholic with a mind like yours recover. He's not saying with an, he doesn't even know that Silkworth is in New York working on this theory of the allergy, and this was the early 30s. It's even the same time. I've never seen an alcoholic with a mind like yours recover. You can't not drink, is what he's saying, in spite of all our therapeutic work together. And Hazard is crushed, and he goes, and Jung says, my advice to you is to seek a spiritual experience. So Hazard comes back to New York City and gets involved with the Oxford groups as they're going on at Calvary Church, which is run by a guy named Sam Shoemaker, and I hope I'll get to him, but I doubt it, looking at the way this timer's going. But that was the start of it. And if the Oxford groups hadn't trained you that you got to go find another, you got to work with another to get them unblocked from their creator, or it just you won't really fully feel the effects of this thing. So he goes and finds Ebby, and then Ebby goes and finds Bill. And then there's that moment in Akron when Bill's got to find another drunk to stay sober. He's not going to sober people. Can you help me stay sober? He needs to find another drunk to stay sober. So Jung was very important, and I just wanted to say Jung had a sign over his door that said, bidden or unbidden, God is present. Bidden or unbidden, God is present. And one of you said to me, you know, you could say, acknowledged or unacknowledged, I am my creator's presence. And that means you are my creator's presence. I thought that was pretty cool. That it's already happening. It's just my mind is somewhere else, lost in its own opinions. Okay. I'd love to hear Sonia talk about oh, nope, gotta go back. Three prayers. Resentment. The resentment prayer is, save me from being angry, show me how I can be helpful. And if I can't be helpful, give me a kindly, tolerant view. Fear prayer, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. What would you have me be? Shows up later on, patient, tolerant, kind, and loving. What would you have me do? Let you demonstrate through me what you can do. That's what the book says. That's the line in the book. Okay. 6 and 7. Didn't even get to talk about sponsorship. key words in 6 and 7 are objectionable. You know, I've been around here long enough to watch people come and watch people go, and the people that seem to do the best have found their drinking objectionable, and they've tried to stop on their own, and they can't. So when they get to Alcoholics Anonymous, they're like, just tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. They're not second guessing us. They're not asking a lot of questions. Well, if I could do that same thing with my own personality, you know, just in traveling out here, I'm 71 years old and I have to manage me. It's not you. I got to line things up so I won't get tweaked and go off and get miserable about something stupid. It's just amazing. So my personality is becoming objectionable. You know, I got an opportunity to go on a small boat down in Chesapeake Bay, and I'm telling myself, oh, this is going to be great. I get to do whatever I want. I'm taking all my spiritual books. I'm going to do all this stuff. You know, I get down there. I'm alone. I don't have to worry about anybody else's happiness. I'm taking care of myself, and I couldn't stand myself. I had to hang out with me, and that wasn't any fun at all. So we in fact, I'm powerless over me. That's the truth of it. And what I love, you know, you say let go, let God. I can't let go, but I can pray for removal. And my first experience of that was experiencing financial fear, and being a finance guy has been a part of my life for a long, long time, and I was feeling financial collapse, in fear of financial collapse, and I wasn't a praying person. Somebody said, pray the fear prayer. What's the fear prayer? Well, it's right on page 68. 67 is about resentment. 68 is about fear. 69 is about sex. Can you remember that? Okay. But it says it. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. And I got something. It was my first experience of conscious contact. I got something. And what I got was, you can be the person I want you to be, and you don't have to be rich to be the person I want you to be. And that person is same thing, patient, tolerant, kind, and loving. Okay. So I just love the seven-step prayer. First of all, it says, my creator. And I heard one of you say, you know, my creator is just like our Father. That's how we start the Lord's Prayer. I try to stay away from, for a lot of reasons, from God and from Him and from Father. But that's all they're saying, our creator. And I love how, you know, I'm doing the third step. It's like I did the third step prayer on my knees, holding hands with a big book step study sponsor. And then I balked for a year and a half at even coming up with a resentment list. I didn't want to come up with a resentment list because I didn't want to get to amends. I was smart enough to see that, gee, the best thing to do is just don't even get started, and that way you'll never. That's the way this thing thinks. And don't forget I'm smart. So at any rate, I hear this guy saying, it was important to acknowledge that he did not create himself. And then he said, if you're struggling with that question, whether or not you created yourself, don't you think if you did create yourself, you could have done a better job? Uh-huh. Okay, I got to go to 10, 11, and 12. I just want to say one thing about amends, and that is that I heard a guy named Bob Olson. I don't know if you've heard, if he's been out here or you've heard him, but he's quite a fellow, and he's been in our program. He's pushing 40 years now, does the steps every year, and he said that he felt 90% of the people inside the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous don't get to 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis, which means they're not getting to amends, which means they're not getting to the prayer for removal, which means they're probably not getting to an inventory. There are parking lots. I mean, a lot of people get through 4 and 5, and we park the car. I'm feeling way better, and I don't need to do this other stuff. So at any rate, I thought that was a startling statistic, and just wanted to throw that out there. All right, step 10. The important words in step 10 for me are continue and the warning about complacency. Continue means don't stop doing what you're doing. You know, that's what I want to do. I want the easier, softer way. But continue to do all the stuff that I'm doing. The first paragraph just runs through the steps. When selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear show up, when restless, irritable, discontent shows up, what am I to do? One of you called it the 10th step protocol. I am to pray at once for removal, which is 6 and 7. I am to share with somebody, which is 5. I am to make amends if called for, 8 and 9. And then what? I'm to turn my mind to service, step 12. Turn my mind to how can I be helpful to somebody else. And then, of course, it repeats it at the end of that section of the proper use of the will. And I love that. The proper use of the will. Each day is a day when we must. We talk about this as suggestions. This doesn't sound like a suggestion to me. Each day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities, not some. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are the questions. That's what's supposed to be in my mind all day long. Is it? Are you kidding me? When we get to a spiritual awakening, what a spiritual awakening is for me is I'm all of a sudden going, dude, it's not about you, you know, because it's always been all about me all the time in terms of everything. And a spiritual awakening is all of a sudden it's like it's not about me. It's about how can I be helpful to my creator? It's about my creator expressing life, goodness and life and love through me. It's not about me. Whoa, big news for me. Okay, step 11 does a lot. You know how it goes. The We start with the evening review. This is one part I've just never been able to do. I live the way I drank, which is just I go hard until I feel like somebody pulled the plug out, and I crash. And so I've never been good about the evening review, other than I at least took the stuff. My sponsor was so good about saying, you know, if you hit anything in the book that you want to understand better, try to put it into your own words. Rewrite it in a way that'll be in your own words. And if you can turn it into a prayer, even better.
I forgot the sex prayer. The sex prayer is, so we ask God to mold our ideals and to help us live up to them.
They're all the same in a way for me, but we don't ask for a resentment ideal. Have you thought about that? You know, we don't ask for a fear ideal, but we do add for a sex conduct ideal. And it doesn't mean, I feel it means all of our behavior. It means our physical behavior, not just our sexual behavior, but how we interact with other beings. So this is the first time when we're actually going for conscious contact. Please mold my ideals and help me live up to them. That's a wonderful prayer. Okay, so step 11. So what I did was I wrote a prayer based on the page where it's talking about the nightly review. And
if you ask me how often I do that,
pretty often. One of the things that I do this big book workshop thing that Marshall was talking about, and after one of them, it was down in Florida at a Hazelden facility. I thought that was cool. And this young woman came up to me and she said, I'm so tired of hearing the old timers talk about hitting their knees. I don't think they really hit their knees. And you know, I've wondered that, why do we say hit our knees? It is like, you know, you're hitting your knee or... So I said to her, well, I can tell you this for sure. When I think a prayer, it has this much power. When I say a prayer out loud, it has this much prayer power. And when I say a prayer out loud on my knees, it has way more power. And of course, then she has to say, well, how often do you get down on your knees and pray? And I said, oh, a couple of times a month. But right after that, but there's a nice end to this story. So I'm coming out here. I'm coming out here to Seaside, and I'm remembering my sponsor's words. He says, you know, you're a lot better preacher than you are a practicer. And why don't you follow your own advice? Because we talk a lot about, you know, my work with others and the problems we run into, and he helps me a lot through that. And so I'm coming out here, and I'm going to be alone I have an RV, and I'm going to be alone in my RV. As much as I love my wife, she has never seen me pray out loud on my knees. I have to be alone. So I know I'm going to be alone. She's not coming this trip. So I start praying morning and evening on my knees out loud, and I'm telling you, my life changed. It just plain did. So at any rate, so then we get the part about in the morning, and I remember reading this line, and it just was astounding for me. This Big Book Step Study sponsor said, all right, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I want you to read pages 83 to 88 every day. I'm a good student. I copy them up. I start reading it and underlining it, and I'm reading about this evening review, and then it says, upon awakening, we ask God to direct our thinking. We especially ask that our thinking be divorced from self-pity, dishonest or self-seeking motives. And I go, what? Because I'm real new and I'm not praying yet. What? What? I am to ask something to direct my beautiful mind? What? I mean, I'm obviously not conveying how preposterous it felt to me, but it felt preposterous. I couldn't believe that. And now I'm finding that's also what a spiritual awakening is for me, that I am willing to ask my Creator to direct my thinking. And I am willing to, divorce is an ugly word,
I am willing to ask that that stuff be removed from me, my dishonesty, my fear, and my selfishness. Two last things. Pause, ask, listen, do. I love hearing people break this thing down to a few words. Dr. Bob, trust God, clean house, help others. Pause, ask, listen, do. In the third step, it says, first of all, we got to quit playing God. So that's number one, quit playing God. I don't even know I'm playing God, but quit it. Why doesn't the step one just say, just quit it? Just quit drinking. So quit playing God. Invite God in. And they tell me how to do that. Invite God in as my director. I'm the actor. I never wanted to be an actor. As my principal, and I'm the agent. Yeah, I like that. That's pretty good. As my father, and I'm the child. As my parent, I'm the child. Well, I would like that. I would like that. I didn't feel a whole lot of that. So that's an important part of that prayer. So last thing on step 11 is... for me lately, you know, the Oxford groups, I didn't get a chance to talk about Frank Buckman, but the guy that started the Oxford groups, he did it because his experience was resentment was blocking him from any relationship with higher power. And the reason we focus on resentment in our process is because of Frank Buckman and the whole Oxford group thing. And the Oxford groups were so big on morning guidance, that's what they called it. Every time in the morning, I'm going to have a quiet period. They suggested you have it with pencil and paper, and you write down whatever you receive when you get quiet and calm. You're able to pause. You're able to ask. You're able to listen, and then hopefully follow through with the guidance. But my mind is so talking to me all the time this is what's working for me now. Higher power, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I'm thinking of saying to that person, or this is what I'm thinking of doing. Red light or green light or yellow light. And what works for me is I get a more intuitive sense of yes, no, maybe, proceed with caution, whatever it is. My sponsor says trouble for him is he gets a yellow light and he speeds up instead of slowing down. But if I get a red light, then I can go, well, then get me out of this. show me how to get out of this without doing any more spiritual harm. But it's made a big difference to me. Okay, step 12, we're really nearing the end now. So when I do this big book workshop thing, we read the two versions of Alcoholic Anonymous number 3. And there's a little short version in A Vision for You, and then the actual story. And we don't read the whole story. But by the way, we read, it's an interesting thing, if you want to try this, one sentence at a time. You got a group of 10, 12 people, and you each read one sentence, because you can't take a vacation. You can't go off thinking about something, waiting for your paragraph to show up. You got to be right there, ready to go. So we read a part of it, and it's just so amazing to me. This is our society's first 12-step call, and Dr. Bob is 2 weeks sober, right? This happens at the end of June 1935. Bill Wilson's 6 months sober. They don't have the book. They don't have any steps, and they go to this guy, and they ask him 5 questions, and... if my sponsor had done this with me, I probably wouldn't be here because I couldn't have answered appropriately. But they ask him 5 questions, and he's talking in his own voice, so you hear his thinking, and it's just beautiful. And the first question is, do you want to stop drinking? That's the first question. And they say, if you don't, we're going to go find somebody that does want to stop drinking. If you do, then we'll ask you the next question. Oh, yeah, I want to stop drinking. Do you think you can do it on your own? Question number 2. And he also says, no, I would have answered, maybe. and then the question number 3 is, do you have any conception working for you of higher power? And he says, yeah, I used to be strong in the church. And then they ask the killer question, number 4 is, are you willing to go to that higher power calmly and without reservation asking for help? I thought that was beautiful. And then when they go review the questions, do you want to stop drinking? He goes, Yeah, for 5 or 6 months till I get my life back to normal. And they go, we got some bad news for you. You got to do this. You got to do this one day at a time. Can you stop for 24 hours? And he says, oh, yeah, I can stop for 24 hours, and proceeds from there. It's a wonderful story if you haven't seen it in a while. Sam Shoemaker was the guy that really, I think, did so much for our fellowship. And so the last thing I do want to say something about is our traditions. And and I love your meetings out here. I love how you read all the traditions. I love one, and one is saying to me the same thing as 12 is saying. And I love, too, about the one ultimate authority. One, our common welfare should come first. And when you get to 12, it starts talking about principles before personalities. So what I love about that is that our common welfare should come before my personality. This is one of the finest ways for me to not make it all about me. So I came to you... My first meeting was Thursday, September 3rd at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I think I remember every word that was spoken at that meeting. This is what I heard: blah 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 blah. I'd love to claim credit for that, but that was somebody else's line. I stole it. Entirely broken, depressed, I literally could not get here from there. No way. And I love you people. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the world really needs us right now. You know, the drugs keep getting stronger and the weapons of violence keep getting stronger, and the world needs our help. So if anything, I would encourage you to be as aggressive as you can about seeking out somebody that you can help, and that we can keep this wonderful fellowship going. I love you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jack. Thanks for letting me share.